All right, if you have your paper with you this evening, you can see that the front page is basically a one single box with all of the scriptures on suffering in the book of 1 Peter. The ones that are bold and not italicized are Christ's suffering, and the ones that are not bolded and are italicized are the sufferings that we have to endure. And the reason I put this here is because this is the last time in the book that Peter's going to refer to Christ's suffering, and he wants to make an application. So we can't really arm ourselves with the same mind unless we understand the mind. And of course, we could find a lot of other verses that would describe these things, but we're just going to content ourselves with what Peter says here. And so as you look at verse 20 of chapter 2, 20, 21, 22, 23, and then as you look at several other passages, 1 Peter 3, 18, we see that Christ had a very, very difficult set of sufferings. Matter of fact, one of the points I'll make a little bit later is that there's no one on earth who could ever say, I've got it worse than Christ. It would not be possible. And so Peter wants that clearly understood. And so that's really what these are all about. And, you know, later on, after we talk about arming ourselves and we get a clear sense of what exactly we're supposed to do, you might want to refer back to this or just read through the book again and look at all these things, because they become a very powerful weapon. The word arm is something that nations do before they go to war. They devise the best possible weapons to become the victors. And that's what God is offering us here. So we turn to the second page, and of course there at the very top we have, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh. Now, I want us to think a little bit here, because that's what we do for him. He suffered for us, we suffer for him. So there is a direct parallel here, and it's something that, again, it's part of the arming, it's part of the weapon that God has given us here. And so Peter uses the common word for drawing a conclusion, because this is the final conclusion, therefore. So he's now going to give us the application that we ought to make. And so on the middle of page 2, I have what I consider to be the four most important points that we need to consider in Christ's suffering. First of all, he suffered for us, leaving an example. Secondly, when he was reviled, he did not revile it again. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. The next one is he bore our sins in his own body on the tree, and we were healed by his stripes. And then lastly here, Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust. And then the secondary fact, I think, that helps us to arm our minds is the last verse in chapter 3, which is he went into heaven. He's at the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers having been made subject to him. So, like I say, this is something we think about every first day of the week. It's not something that's strange to us. It's not something that's new to us. Maybe not these specific concepts, but the fact that he died for our sins, the fact that he became flesh and dwelt among us and suffered, is part of the Lord's Supper. So this is the foundation of this arming that we're going to have to understand. And so we need to make some conclusions. But before I do that, anybody have any thoughts on what we were talking about as far as Christ suffering for us in the flesh? Okay, well, in the middle of page 2, I point out that there's a couple of conclusions that we need to draw. First of all, no one will ever suffer to the depth that Jesus did. So regardless of what we have to deal with, His example will get us through it. And secondly, we see the graphic illustration of the reward for that suffering. So Jesus suffered more than anyone else would suffer, and Jesus was rewarded more than anyone else can be rewarded. But he makes it very clear, you know, and you see this in the the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are those who are persecuted, for great is your reward in heaven. So the exact same thing that happened to Jesus could happen to us, and the similar reward as well. And so we need to keep that in mind. Our persecution is just a tiny example, just a tiny step into what Jesus was willing to endure. And so there's no stigma attached to it. It shouldn't make us angry. It shouldn't make us feel guilty. It shouldn't create within us a desire to stop serving the Lord. It's just the natural part of being a Christian. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you. If they receive my word, they'll receive you as you preach my word. So there really isn't a lot of difference between suffering for righteousness' sake. You remember Jesus made that application again in the Sermon on the Mount. He said, "For so they persecuted the prophets." So, and then when he talked to the Pharisees toward the end of his ministry, he said, "All of the blood of all the prophets who have been slain from the foundation of the world, starting with Abel." So Abel in Genesis chapter 4 was the first prophet who was killed for righteousness' sake. He was the first prophet who was killed for preaching by inspiration to a sinner, and Cain killed him for it. And that has continued right up until today. Of course, we don't have prophets anymore, but we still have the same exact situation. So this is really fundamental. And as I said, if we're taking the Lord's Supper properly, then this is not new to us. It's not, but the application will be new to us. And so he brings that up in the next statement when he says, "Arm yourselves also with the same mind." And you can see the definition of this word arm. Excuse me. And it basically means preparation, making or getting ready for something. Originally, it meant preparing food. Then one of the translators wrote that it also meant to get your chariot horses ready before you hitch them to the chariot. But in the New Testament, when the Greek word was used in the New Testament, it was primarily focused on soldiers and ships. So when there's a war and you're preparing to go to war, you will select the best possible armor, both offensive and defensive armor, that you can find. And of course, I was reading today that we've now developed a new way of developing our own armed forces. And so it just continues. We have arms now that are very different from the ones they had in their day, and that's just what nations do. They try to find ways to protect themselves. Well, we have an adversary who's seeking whom he can destroy, and we need to have the armor to be able to get through that, because this battle is always just right over the horizon. And it's a battle for the mind and the emotions. You know, persecution is only given to create submission. The real focus of all persecution is to get us to stop. Get us to stop preaching. Get us to stop living the Christian life. Get us to conform to their way of thinking. And of course, you can stop persecution immediately. That's all you have to do, is just agree with them or don't stand up to them. But of course, if you do that, you've lost the battle. So before this persecution or suffering comes into our lives, we've got to be forearmed. We've got to be prepared for that. And of course, he hasn't really explained how we arm ourselves yet. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. But the point is that we do have weapons. And if you look on the bottom of page 3, I've kind of categorized the different weapons that God has given to us. He tells us in 2 Corinthians chapter 10 that the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but mighty in God. So these are powerful weapons. And like I said, we wouldn't understand them. You know, you think about it, if we could go back in time and show the Romans a rifle or a pistol or a bomb, and they would look at that and say, that doesn't look very dangerous to me, because they wouldn't understand it. Well, that's kind of how the scriptures are to some people. They don't really understand. For example, you look down at the passage in Ephesians 6. The armor of God is going to make us strong and powerful, and then you read them, and it's, what is it? Well, it's the breastplate of righteousness, the shield of faith, the waist with truth, feet with the preparation of the gospel, helmet of salvation. So God sees these as weapons. And when you think about it, when Jesus was involved in probably the most titanic battle this earth has ever seen, and that would be the one where Satan comes to him to try to get him to sin with those three forms of temptation, and Jesus had his weapons. He was forearmed. He was totally prepared, and he shut Satan down by his preparation and the law. He simply quoted scripture. And if we can do that, then we are going to be offensive, because we can preach the word, be ready in season and out of season, and defensive, we have the proper answers when these things come into our mind. I'm not talking about answering other people. I'm talking about answering ourselves. Sometimes when you get doubts, you need an answer. Sometimes when you get discouraged or confused or disappointed. You know, Jesus talked about that in the parable of the sower. Those who, when persecution or tribulation arises because of the word, they stumble. Well, we all feel like we might stumble when that happens, but most of us have answers. Most of us have reasons. Most of us have already developed the idea that when I found the treasure in the field, I'm ready to sell all that I have, and it isn't going to stop just because somebody wants to be to oppose that. All right, so before we go any further with this concept of weapons, anybody have a comment or like to say anything? Okay, so to this list, you know, you've got these this group of scriptures on the middle of page 3, 2 Corinthians 10, 2 Corinthians 6, Romans 13, Ephesians 6. These are all verses about the weapons that we have as Christians, and hopefully these are well-known texts to us. We've used them, we've developed them, we understand what the armor of righteousness is, we understand how it's on the right hand and on the left, we understand the armor of light and the armor of God. Well, Peter now adds another. This again is an offensive weapon. This is something that we are armed with, we are ready to fight back with. And so it's an interesting fighting back, because the worldly persecutor is never going to see it. The worldly persecutor, I mean, we can't revile again. We have to turn the other cheek. We have to go the second mile. So what do I mean? You're armed and ready to defend or protect yourself with this offensive weapon. Well, it's mental, because the battle is mental. It's spiritual, because the battle is spiritual. Now, they may not recognize that they're in the middle of a spiritual battle, but they're simply tools of Satan. And Satan's going to use them to discourage us, crush us, destroy us, whatever it takes to get the message off of the earth. That's what he did with the Lord. It didn't work, because after the Lord was killed, the victory became much more secure as the church started and as people started going everywhere preaching the word. And same thing is true today. And hopefully if the terrible persecutions that we read about in the scriptures become part of the world again, you and I will be armed. We'll be ready. We will be prepared for that. And so we will be prepared if we arm ourselves with the same mind. Now, that's the key here. The key is unlocking Jesus' mind and then making his mind our mind. Now, Paul said exactly the same thing. I'm on the middle of page 4 now, but he said, have this mind among yourselves, which was in Christ Jesus, who did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. Now, this is an issue that we all face. We all have dignity. We all have a sense of self-esteem. And of course, persecution is beneath our dignity. Persecution pushes us into a situation where people get angry, where people get discouraged or frustrated because they don't have the right mind. Jesus had much more reasons not to give up what was his by right, and yet he didn't grasp it. He emptied himself and humbled himself to the point of death. Now, I've got to unlock that mind. That's what Paul said. Have this mind in yourselves. So I've got to understand that. You've got to understand that. Otherwise, you're not armed. Jesus is the example. Remember, we saw that back in chapter 2 and chapter 3, that he is the writing copy, just like in primary school, first grade, you walk in and here's all these diagrams all the way around the room of how to make letters. And Jesus is that writing copy. And so the same thing in Hebrews chapter 12, looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross. I've got to unlock that mind. I can't have joy if I can't understand how he had it. If I think that he was mistreated and he was improperly dealt with, and I feel like that shouldn't have happened, then when it comes to me, I'm going to feel exactly the same way. But if we understand, this is what had to be. It was by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God. Jesus knew when he came what he was going to have to deal with. Well, we know before it comes what we're going to have to deal with. But if we don't have the same thinking, the same process of thinking, the same reasoning, the same reasons, the same motivations and hopes that lead to joy and lead to a humbling, we can humble ourselves if we recognize that humbling ourselves is not demeaning, it's not lowering ourselves. Problem with the pride of life. Many people, as Christians, when they're persecuted, lash back. Well, why would they lash back? Because it's not fair and because it's beneath their dignity and because they're just like the world. If the world persecutes you, you want to go back at them. You want to persecute them. Well, that's not what Jesus did, and that's not what we're going to do or should do. And therefore, we got a lot of work to do. We got a lot of arming to do if we're going to be able to handle that. All right, we're moving away now from this arming. So does anybody have any questions or thoughts or ideas, anything else that would make this clearer for people? Okay, well, we're starting to transition now into a different realm. We're starting to transition into the rest of the time we have on earth and how suffering can help us overcome our sinful desires. Help suffering can be very beneficial to this process of putting off the old man and putting on the new man. And so he's going to make this transition by saying, he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. So our fleshly sufferings, which would be beatings or mockings or scourgings or laughing, persecution of any sort in the flesh, in the physical realm, anyone who's been through that has ceased from sin. Now, this is the reason and it is the cause. So the reason that arming ourselves with the same mind is so powerful is because not only does it prepare us for persecution, but it also prepares us to cease from sin. Now, this is a very tough expression. It took me quite a while today to work through it, and I'm still not sure I have it clearly, but some people offered, well, he's talking about death here, because if you suffer to the point of death, then you cease from sin. Well, he doesn't say he suffered to death. That's not really there. So I don't think that's the answer. Other people see Romans chapter 6, where we die with Christ. And once we die with Christ, we cease from sin. But that doesn't fit the context of Romans, because he goes on to say that after we are baptized, we have to make the choice whether we're going to bring our instruments for righteousness or unrighteousness. So that really doesn't fit it either. So if you'll turn to the top of page 5, I wrote down a quote from one of the people. This guy lived in the mid-1800s, and he said something that really got me to thinking. I won't read what he had to say right now. You can look at it later if you'd like. But I think that what I came up with is that when suffering commences, instead of the sin of falling away or compromise, the power to endure develops. Now, as the power of the ability to endure develops, so also does our ability to endure and fight against sin. And I started thinking about James. James, let me read James chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, or 2 through 4. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into manifold trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, and let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Now, being perfect and complete appears to be just as big a stretch as the disciple who has ceased from sin. So I think that you can't suffer in the flesh to keep from sinning while at the same time easily giving in to sin. It's a contradiction. If you have enough strength to endure persecution, you have enough strength to endure lust of the flesh. You have enough strength to endure the pride of life. You just have to change your focus. And I think that's what Peter's trying to do here. He's trying to help us understand. And, you know, the last few weeks, as we've watched our country change so quickly, I've really gone through this process of what he's talking about here, because you start realizing that if the world changes and the prosperity and even persecution might arise, all these things we're working for, they don't have any value. And you just, your whole focus, your whole perspective changes. And so Peter says you'll cease from sin. James says you'll be perfect, complete, and in lack of nothing. So the ability to suffer persecution, the ability to go through various trials, are also gaining the strength to cease from sin. Now, as I said, I'm not super perfectly happy with that answer, but it's kind of like last week with, or 2 weeks ago with Noah, Jesus going to the spirits in prison. This is another one of those verses. How do we cease from sin? And it's in the perfect tense, which means it's something that happened in the past, and the effects of it are continuing right up to the present moment. Except, as John said, we can't say that. We can't say we have no sin. If we do, we deceive ourselves. So Peter's certainly not saying that. When he says we've ceased from sin, he doesn't mean that we no longer sin, because John said if you say that, you're wrong. So I think it has to do with the balancing scale. And on one side of the scale is my ability to endure persecution, and on the other side is my ability to stop sinning. And the higher I get with the ability to endure persecution and go through persecution, the stronger I can become in the ability to conquer and overcome sin. Anybody else have any thoughts on that? Like I say, it's a bit of a stretch. It's a struggle, but it was the best I could come up with after a couple hours. Okay.
Well, and like I say, I don't think we have to understand every aspect of what Peter's saying here. It'd be wonderful if we could, and maybe someday we will as we keep studying it. But the central point is that if we arm ourselves with the mind of Christ to endure persecution, we'll also be arming ourselves with the mind of Christ to endure all other temptations. And so, just as Jesus was perfect, if I arm myself with his mind, that's the direction I'm heading in. And then hopefully, as I say, someday we can just push sin far and far and far enough away that we are reaching this level where Peter's describing here. But as we move into verse 2, in the middle of page 5 now, the end that arming ourselves with the same mind, the end is to live to the will of God. So, and it's interesting, in the Garden of Gethsemane, you remember what got Jesus through it? He's sweating his blood. He's crying with strong cries. Hebrews chapter, I think chapter 4, he's crying with strong cries to him who could deliver him. And God didn't answer. He didn't answer in the affirmative. So Jesus answered for him, "Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." So here's a direct tie between the mind of Jesus and our mind. If we stop living in our own will and we start living for the will of God, we are arming ourselves not only to get through persecution, but also to get rid of sin. Because sin, as Jesus said, if you don't cut it off, pluck it out, and cast it away from you, then your whole body can be cast into hell. And so these little besetting sins that keep plaguing us, we've got to put forth all the effort we can to cut them off. And this is the direction. We start with suffering. Then we move to arming ourselves with the mind of Christ. Then we move to this, I'm not going to live the rest of my time as a Christian in the flesh. I'm not going to live doing the will or in the lust of the flesh. So the purpose of arming ourselves with the mind of Christ is so that we will no longer look at the rest of our lives in the same way. Now, on the top of page 6, I have an hourglass. And the hourglass is representative of the word, what is remaining besides or left over. It's the Greek word. You see the definition there on the top of page 6. And there is nothing that can wake God's people up to the momentary nature of this life than to endure suffering. And those people are going to be able to look at the sand that's already gone in and the sand that is left. And of course, we focus on that, but then we don't have any guarantee. We don't know that we're going to live to 80. The reason by strength, most people live to 80, so we kind of factor that in. So, some of us are past 80, and so most of the sand is in the bottom there. And we don't know how much longer, we don't know how much time is left, but that time that's in the upper portion is what God is talking about here. This is what's ours. What's in the bottom portion is gone forever. And so the rest of our time needs to be redirected, needs to be directed toward the ability to suffer, needs to be directed toward the ability to cease from sin, and it needs to be directed toward the ability or towards the ability to see the will of God. Like Jesus saw it. He said, I have come to do thy will, O God. He said, my meat is to do the will of him who sent me and accomplish his work. He said, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So, and he also said, not everyone who calls me Lord, Lord, but only those who do the will of my Father. So the will of God is crucial. But unfortunately, we also have the lust of men. Now, the Greek word for lust is kind of an interesting word. I'm sure you've heard it before. It's epithumeo or epithumia, depending on whether it's a noun or a verb. And the idea, the thumos, is to the Greek mind. It is that which can swell and surge. The thumos is used of plants. When you see a plant that's in its baby stage, you come back a few weeks later and it has just swelled up into something much larger. And so they use that term, first of all, to describe anger. Because when you first feel anger, it's just a small little thing, but it surges up inside of you until that's all there is. And so it can swell and surge in an instant to become completely overwhelming. Well, that's how anger works. But anger's not the only thing. It can be sexual desire. It can be greed. It can be fear. It can be discouragement. There's lots of things that can just well up inside of us that we would call a lust. Now, the Greeks, and of course all Gentiles, they like that. They stoke it. That's what the word epi is for. Epi means that you're sitting on top of it and you want it to get bigger and bigger. And so the man who is involved with sexual desire or alcohol or drugs or gambling or greed or anger, sometimes they nurse it. Sometimes they feed it. Sometimes they want it to grow. They see it as a pleasurable thing, although Peter, we'll look at this verse in a few minutes, says that it ultimately becomes our master. And that's the danger of any lust, is that it can ultimately become so big that you don't have any control. You are lost to it. Of course, we see that in alcoholic. We see that with these gambling commercials where they, at the end of the commercial, they say, if you have a gambling addiction, call this number, because they recognize it just completely takes over and ruins a life. All right, anybody have any questions or thoughts on this concept of lust and not living the rest of our time for that lust? Okay, then, he moves to the will of God. And the definition for will is on the bottom of page 6. And it's very simple. It just means what you want, what you've determined, what you plan. So, you know, it's interesting that that's what we write up when we are thinking about dying. We want people to know our will. We want people to know what we want done with, how we want our property to be allocated. That's our will. That's our desire. Well, the New Testament is Christ's will, and it's God's will. It's what they want to be done. And so God has a plan for everything. And it's fascinating because everything else in the creation except man with free will, and that's an interesting term in itself, free will. It means I have the right to choose. I have the right to choose whether I'm going to serve God or not. And so the free will that man has is such a powerful, wonderful commodity. Some people ask sometimes, I wonder why God gave us that free will. It has certainly created a lot of problems in the world. But the reason is that if without free will, we're just robots. We're just tape recorders. We are programmed to say, I love you, God. I'll serve you, God. But it doesn't mean anything because we can't do anything else. I've often illustrated it. If I'm lonely, so I go buy a tape recorder and I say, Alan, you're the greatest guy that ever lived. I love you so much. You are such a wonderful person. There's nobody like you in all the earth. I can play that back 100 times and it's not going to comfort me at all. Because it doesn't mean anything unless somebody with free will says it. Somebody who could say, you're the worst person in the world, but they do say, I think you're the best person in the world. That's what God wanted. He wanted people who would choose to serve him, who would choose to love him, who would choose to do his will. And he promises eternal life to those kinds of people. But again, we have two conflicting wills here. We have what I call a clash of wills. And so, you know, on the top of page 7 now, what do you do when there's two opinions? Mine and God. Two desires. Mine and God. Two goals, mine and God. Two destinations, God's and mine. Well, those are interesting questions because we've already answered them. We do have different desires than God. We do have different goals than God. We don't want that to be. We're trying to overcome it, but it's still there. And from time to time, we see it rear up. Now, the more it rears up, the more we're doing the will of the Gentiles and the less that we're doing the will of God. So when the clash comes between the will of man and the will of God, the will of Gentiles and the will of God, my will and the will of God, torn in both directions, but only one can prevail. And so Peter is really, really emphasizing, and he's going to go into a lot of vocabulary here in a moment about what he's talking about, things that can trip us up, things that man thinks are so wonderful because, you know, as we've talked about in the past, when God says something is wrong, for many people, it makes it more enticing. It makes it more exciting. There's a risk. There is an option here that some people, you know, we call it the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. Even animals like to pass through the barrier, through the boundary for some reason. That's just the way that we are. So, but we have to master that. That's what got Eve in trouble. Satan gave her a reason to long for something that was forbidden, and she jumped over every fence, but it didn't work out the way she wanted it to, and no sin ever works out the way we want it to. So once again now, we come back to this concept of the rest of your time. And so you can see in the middle of page 7, I have another, well, it's actually the same hourglass, but this time I have two statements. One is the time, and let's just make the that thin section between the separation where that's when we were converted. And so everything below is the time we spent doing the will of the Gentiles, and everything above is the time we have the opportunity to do the will of God. And I don't think there's anything more that creates a greater heartache than looking back on the time we're baptized and realizing that I did not use that time very well in whatever direction it might be. It might be this sin, it might be this weakness, it might be our responsibilities and obligations, it might be our attendance, our prayer life, our ability to worship properly. But every time we get brought face to face with it, we start getting that twinge of conscience because we know that we should be here. And we could be there. And so Peter, like I said, he brings it up, makes it very clear. He says, we've spent enough of our past lifetime. Time is short, and we don't have much time. Eternity is just around the corner, and eternity is eternity. You can't change anything. It's appointed unto man once to die, and that's it. And we will have an eternity to regret what we should have done, but didn't do. If you've ever watched or read the book Dickens on The Christmas Carol, where Scrooge is able to look back on his life with regret and yet change it in the end. Well, that's okay as long as we're alive. And so that's what Peter's driving at here. We've had time. And we've squandered it. We've spent enough of our past lifetime now. That may be 10 years, it may be 50 years, depends on when, like I say, that bottleneck is when we're converted. And then we have the time that's been wasted and the time that is now ours to not waste. But of course, as more and more of that sand goes through that bottleneck, what you see is either a squandered life of regret and disappointment, or a life where we suffered with Christ, we ceased from sin, we grew and developed, we became the people that we always wanted to be. Not to perfection, as I say, every Christian can think more than they can do. But that doesn't mean they're squandering their life, because we're constantly learning more, and so our ability to see higher and see further ahead It's always going to make us like Paul, forgetting what lies behind, pressing on to what lies ahead. I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. So this is where Peter is taking us. And pretty soon we're going to read, if the righteous are scarcely saved, where will the unrighteous and ungodly be? And, of course, where will the unfaithful Christian be if the truly righteous Christian are just barely saved? And we'll talk about that in a few weeks, how they're scarcely saved. But time is short. Anybody want to add anything to this? Okay, well, the terrible time where we wasted and squandered like the prodigal son should be a great heartache to us now. Like Paul said, I consider it rubbish. It was such a waste. Waste of time, waste of resources, waste of opportunity, waste in so many ways. Just like that poor kid who squandered his entire inheritance on harlots. And a lot of us can look back, and I'm not saying with harlots, but with things that were futile, worthless, had no value. And so we can't change that. But now we can. We know the will of God. We know our will. When we make our will His will, then we can look back on it appropriately. Now, Paul sums this up in Romans 6. It's the bottom of page 7. We were slaves of sin. That's the bottom portion. We were slaves of sin. And we were free in regard of righteousness. We didn't know anything about it. What fruit did you have in the things that you're now ashamed of? So we look back on, what did I actually produce before I became a Christian? What did I actually do that God's going to be able to say, well done, good and faithful servant? And the sad reality is, there isn't anything. But now we have this opportunity. As Paul says in verse 22 there, you have your fruit to holiness and the end, everlasting life. So there's a choice. There's the will of the Gentiles. Let's go ahead and turn now to page 8. We see the definition of will is a little different than the previous word, but it means basically the same thing. This is the word in Hebrews. Where it says that God is able, that was a previous one. This word's only used three times in the New Testament, and it basically has the idea of a plan, project, a purpose, a goal, an intention, or a tendency. So Gentiles who have left God behind, they have their own purpose and goal. They've replaced God's purpose. God's purpose is to realize the eternal consequences of what we do, bring our will under His will, bring our desires and submit to His, and live on. And that's the interesting conundrum here. You know, this isn't the rest of our time. That little top portion of the hourglass, that's not the rest of our time. If we're serving God, it's the rest of our time here. But then the hourglass gets shattered and we don't have an hourglass anymore. We have eternity. And that's what we want. And that's the direction we're going in. And we don't want to squander or waste anything. We want to use the rest of that hourglass so that when it shatters at death, we have eternity. And so when the Gentiles, their goal in life is, if it feels good, do it. Let's eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Let's use our bodies to give in to our lusts and desires. And that's the disconnect. That's the contrast between the will of God and the Gentiles. Well, we live among Gentiles. Everybody we know outside of the church is a Gentile. Everybody we know outside of the church, that's their will, to prosper, to enjoy the things of this life, maybe to give in to a few sins that they enjoy giving into, and that's all they want out of life. Well, we want a whole lot more than that. And it's interesting, though, that that's why they persecute us. They persecute us because we make them uncomfortable. We starkly show that their lifestyle is not appropriate. And of course, let me rephrase that. We show that if we're letting our light shine. We show that if we are putting forth the effort necessary to suffer for sin, to suffer for righteousness and to cease from sin. And like Paul said, or Peter said back in 1 Peter 2, 9 through 11, that we need to have our conduct honorable among the Gentiles, and we need to abstain from fleshly lust. Now, when we do that, it's going to lead to wonderful things. It's going to lead to them seeing what their life is. Now, hopefully, they'll do what Peter's going to say in a few verses, which is sanctify the Lord God in your heart and be ready to give an answer. Hopefully, they'll start asking. But that's the will of the Gentiles. And Paul talks about it. I guess we got a little bit of time. Let's look at that verse on the bottom of page 8, Ephesians 4. I say and testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles, in the futility of their mind. Well, here's the will of the Gentiles: emptiness, futility, worthlessness. Again, the very things that we're ashamed of now, those are the things that these people, they think that's the way, they think the way we used to think. They think that this is useful. They think that this is valuable. They think this is fun. But it's in the futility of their own mind. It's actually, if we could see the fact that by this action, I will spend eternity and eternity burning and wishing that I had lived a different life. Well, boy, if I can see that, I'm going to see the futility of this line of thinking. Understanding darkened, alienated from the life of God because either their ignorance or their hardness of heart. So these are the people that we must avoid. They're the evil companionship that corrupts good morals. And so, but we once walked among them. And this word walk is used about 150 times in the New Testament, and about 99.99% of the time it's used for literal walking. Walking to the Sea of Galilee, walking to Capernaum, walking to Jerusalem. They're just walking. That's how they moved around. Well, it took on the idea of when we're walking. Well, we're either walking toward things that are sinful or we're walking toward things that are godly. And so before we became a Christian, we were a people who were living our lives after the lusts of men. All right. Any thoughts, questions, comments?
Yeah, Alan, it's too bad this teaching isn't relevant today. You read this. This is just for them people back then, And it's such timeless. You think about when it was written and how man that has read this centuries and years after this was written, and it's so relevant today. And of course, it's relevant, exactly what you're saying now. And there's just a pattern of behavior that man has not broke. It's just over and over and over again.
Well, what you're saying is what Solomon said: that which has been is that which will be. And the world looks at the Bible and says it's ancient, it's outdated, it's obsolete. But we don't see it that way at all. I think it's just as pertinent and practical and useful and valuable as it was when it was written. Anything else, Rob?
Brian and I were talking along this line, not exactly, but how we should, is our life really focused upon doing God's will? We can get so caught up with this world and what we want. And we've been talking about just opportunities, especially with the internet and the technologies. And it kind of comes back to what you were talking about, the will of God. It's like God is watching. Are we using the opportunities to do his will? Or are we just living unto ourselves? And like you're saying, the hourglass the sand is turning down through that hourglass. And, you know, we're going to look back on our life and say, you know, what did I really do for the Lord? How much time in my day do I work for the Lord, or do I work for myself? And it's very sobering. Even if we're at work, we're working under the Lord, we're providing, we're having opportunities. And if not, we're just like the Gentiles.
Well, and of course that takes us back to what James chapter 4, verse 19, I think it is, to him who knoweth to do good and doesn't do it, that's sin. So there's sins of omission, sins of commission. Anybody else before we move into this list of set of vocabulary words that we're going to be looking at from till the end of the class? Okay, well, we start with a word that really in the English language, we just don't really have a word to describe it. We use the word lewdness or lasciviousness, but unfortunately, that primarily, in most people's mind, is a focus on sexual things. And of course, it is about sexual things, but not exclusively. It's more of an attitude and state of mind than it is a specific sin. And so if you look at the definitions, I think Trench really named it when he said, this word is best described as wanton, lawless insolence. And I think that really captures it, because and this is the problem with sexual desire. You can't fulfill it without letting it come out in the light of day. And as soon as it comes out in the light of day, because you have to influence someone if you're going to be promiscuous, and the influence, the fact that you would willingly let somebody else even see that you have those feelings, is wanton, lawless insolence. And it's kind of interesting. You look at young children and they're ashamed. They have a sense of shame. And there's a limit to how far they can go. But as we grow into adults, we reach a point where we don't care anymore. We don't care the drunk or these people today that are coming out. I mean, they're just blatant and on and open about it. And they're arrogant about it. They're challenging. What are you going to do about this? And so this is all based on the concept of lasciviousness. It means lacking moral restraint, not caring, not allowing the morals and the sensibilities of the public. They're trying to change that. And how do you do that? Well, you just get in their face. You sin so openly and so publicly. Well, who can do that? Well, only people who have this, quote, wanton, lawless, insolent. They won't acknowledge restraint. They will dare to do whatever they can imagine or think about. And we're seeing a lot of lasciviousness today in our country. And it's part of the will of the Gentiles. And so, you know, as I say, lasciviousness, we kind of focus, and I thought Trench kind of hit it when he said, our translators had impurities and lust of the flesh exclusively in their eye, but they gave the word too narrow a meaning. And I tend to agree with that after looking at all the definitions through the years. I think that this wanton, lawless insolence, you know, when we sin, we hide it. We're ashamed of it. We wish we'd never done it. We hope nobody ever finds out about it. There's no lasciviousness in us. But when you reach a point where you don't care, and of course that's what once saved, always saved does. It turns people. And Jude talks about that, and Peter talks about that, the fact that these false doctrines lead people who think they're Christians into lasciviousness. You can do this without losing your soul. You can be a homosexual. You can be a drunkard. You can be an adulterer. We think that God will forgive that. Well, what does that lead to? Well, I'm going to become an adulterer, and I don't care if anybody knows about it because God's going to save me anyway. So this is the issue with this lasciviousness or this lewdness.
Alan?
Yes.
It's very, very interesting discussion. I have a feeling that there are steps that we probably go through to get to the idea that Trench gives to us here. And early on, it seems that when people lose their ability to blush, and what I'm talking about there is whenever sin is prevalent, a Christian that is aware of sin normally becomes very uncomfortable. They don't want to be around it. And yes, many times they blush. And when we can take and probably see it more practical with the way we carry ourselves or the dress that we have, the way that we react with other people, that when we don't do it right and proper and respectful, and we don't portray ourselves in actuality that like we are, then we have a tendency to blush. We become very uncomfortable. But once we pass that, once we pass that stage, then you might as well, the door's open, the horse is going to get out. And I can speak from personal experience way back that I was in that condition myself. I know what I'm talking about. It didn't start with just immediately jumping right into something that wasn't right. People have a tendency to work themselves up into it.
I definitely agree with that. Paul talks about people whose conscience is seared.
Yes.
And they don't even feel bad. And they don't care. And like I said, I'm just shocked. It's very vexing, as we talked about Sunday night. It's very vexing. We see it in entertainment, but now we're not seeing it in entertainment.
No.
We're seeing these people right out in the open.
Yeah.
Doing things that are it's not funny, but you're just shocked. You're just so overwhelmed with shock that people could be like that.
You know, one thing that I've noticed through this discussion we've had, and I appreciate the hourglass that you put in there, and that's so true. I've looked at when a person turns his life around and he repents, that God has given us the ability to turn the hourglass over. And we can't relive the past, but there's some another period of time that God has granted us. How much time? I have no idea. But a lot of times, if we're in the depths of drinking, drugs, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, this wantonness, outrageousness, shamefulness, and insolence. Insolence is a word that hurts me, because there's an attitude, a deep-seated attitude there that says, I don't care who you are, and I don't care what you think, I'm going to do it anyway. And that's where a lot of our society is, and that's where a lot of people that have been Christians for years, when they fall away, that's where they march right off into that avenue.
Yeah, what's agonizing is when it's one of your kids who's just said, yes, I'm not going to do anything you say anymore.
Or relatives.
Yeah, or a relative.
They know better. They know better. But it's the way life is. Anyway, thanks for bringing this up and for talking about it. I appreciate it.
Sure. All right. Well, it's 8:30, so we'll go ahead and stop there.
I didn't realize I talked so long.
Oh, no, you didn't talk that long. Yeah, you took the whole hour, Virgil. I can't believe it. No, I appreciate it. Sometimes when I ask for you guys' comments, I'm counting on you guys to say something, and sometimes it doesn't happen. Although I appreciate the fact that you guys give me a lot of time so that I can get through the information that we have. All right. Anybody else have a question or comment or thought before we...
Just a fast thing that Philippians 3:19 talks about, those people whose glory is in their shame. I mean, that just seems to... That says it about as well as this wanton lawless and this insolence that you were talking about.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, remember the old, may the Lord strike me dead if I'm not telling you the truth, some person. I tell you, people say the craziest things. And you're right, Ken. They glory in their shame. Okay, I think I asked Virgil to lead us in a closing prayer, so let's go ahead and wind down our class this evening. Thanks a lot, everybody. I really enjoyed it.